Hello, I'm Rachel Schofield. Welcome to the Bokomi podcast, introducing you to books full of original, memorable insights, or OMI, from the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture.
Hi, I'm Elspeth Kirkman, author of Behavioural Insights, and this is my OMI for Bokomi.
In this episode, we challenge you to consider how much of your behaviour is influenced by factors you aren't even conscious of. You may think you are the embodiment of rational decision-making, but Elspeth Kirkman will show you otherwise.
Okay, I've got this cough and it's Grandma's birthday and Grandma would be absolutely devastated if I didn't go to her 100th birthday. I'm probably all right to just go because I don't think I've got coronavirus. When actually, if you zoomed out and you thought there's a small chance that you've got coronavirus and you're going to go and see your 100-year-old grandma, obviously that's not the right thing to do. And yet we kind of tell ourselves these stories and we kind of try and reason as to why we should be able to do something because it feels like it's the right thing to do, even though when you sort of impose the bigger framework, it's absolutely not.
Along with fellow expert Michael Hallsworth, Elspeth is the author of Behavioural Insights. Behavioural Insights is a surprisingly new discipline, and this book will introduce you to its growing power. It's all about attacking practical problems by using real evidence about human behaviour. So imagine you're running the country. You want to help unemployed people find work faster. You want to help social workers improve their decision-making under pressure. You want to tackle school attendance and attainment. Well, through her work at the Behavioural Insights team, or BIT, Elspeth Kirkman has helped leaders tackle all these problems by studying how people actually respond to different policies and prompts and not rely on guesswork. Elspeth Kirkman, welcome to Bokomi.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a fascinating book, and I have done it justice with that introduction? I mean, it's about looking at how we as human beings actually behave versus how we think people are going to behave.
I think you've done it incredible justice. I'd actually quite like to just copy everything that you said and use that as the blurb forever for now. It was very good.
So, I mean, are you somebody who's always been interested in the way people behave? I have a picture of you sort of sitting in cafes and sort of studying people as they go about their daily life and thinking, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I'm definitely a bit of a, I'm definitely chronically curious about that. My background actually is not necessarily the most kind of conventional in terms of how one might become a behavioral scientist. So I originally studied English literature at university, but if I look back at what motivated that and what I found to be particularly interesting about how great writers sort of document human existence, it really does intersect in a way that might be somewhat surprising at a superficial level with the way that behavioral scientists, behavioral economists, psychologists sort of think about the world. It's just, you know, trying to unpack what is it that led people to making the decisions they did and how do those decisions sort of change the trajectory of a life.
And one thing that really struck me that comes early on in the book is that assertion, and I guess it's obvious when you think about it, but that a lot of our behavior isn't driven by us having a process in our brain that goes, shall I do this or that, and shall I weigh up the pros and the cons. It's a much more intuitive, habitual, non-conscious kind of process, and that's what you're trying to tap into.
Exactly that. And I think, you know, there's a way of characterizing this, which is sort of negative and lampoons us stupid humans and says, oh, you know, look at us kind of sleepwalking through life and making these decisions that we don't even realize we're making and all these sort of subconscious or non-conscious factors that influence them. But actually, if you think about the number of decisions you have to make on a day-to-day basis, the kind of complexity of just navigating the world, you need to have so much of that stuff on autopilot and so much of that stuff encoded in these sort of rules of thumb or shortcut ways of doing things just to get through the day and to conserve enough energy to sort of notice and really attend to the big decisions that you might have to make. And so I just think it's this fascinating, it's actually a, you know, very smart sort of set of heuristics that we've developed to help us kind of navigate our existence.
I'm going to jump on you there because I kept reading in the book the word heuristics and I had to look it up. So just help people who haven't come across this word because I suspect you might use it again.
I suspect I might, and good for calling me out on it. It basically just means rules of thumb. So, for example, we tend to want to take the path of least resistance. So if there's any sort of friction or difficulty involved in doing something, we'll take the other course that's very easy. Or we might have a heuristic or rule of thumb embedded in our brains, which is follow the crowd whenever possible, which again is, you know, it sounds quite sort of stupid and basic when you spell it out like that. But if you think about from even an evolutionary perspective, if you were the one that was sort of off doing your own thing and not following the crowd, you're probably less likely to survive in the wild and all of those kinds of things. So a lot of these rules do have these sort of very deep, intuitive, sensible roots.
And yet others, and it's this kind of thing that perhaps governments and policymakers haven't tapped into, are maybe... they're obvious when you point them out in the book, but you wouldn't think of them. So one that really jumped at me was that we like to go down the middle. So if you're offered kind of at Starbucks or your local coffee shop, you're offered, do you want small, medium or large? And you can't decide, you probably go medium. And that can have actually interesting implications for policy on things like healthy eating and so on when it comes to portion control.
Exactly. And you know, the specific example that we use, I think from memory, is one where the middle option changes size, but people still pick it. So they're not attending at all to how big their coffee is. They're attending to whether it's the middle option, exactly as you say. And I think, again, one of the things that is useful to think about in that is, why do people do that? And sometimes it's not just that the rule is pick the middle option for the middle option's sake. It's that you have some sort of underlying assumption about why it might be the middle option. So maybe, you know, somebody who's attended to this and thought about it much more carefully than you has decided that this is sort of the right portion size, and you're reading some sort of signal into it. I think a good example of that is the use of defaults. So what happens if you don't make a decision? What's the do nothing option? What's the path of least resistance? There's a really interesting study on end of life care in American hospitals, where the default pathway at end of life care is either to do the kind of comfort option, which is not continuing to treat somebody, but just making sure that they're comfortable and, you know, in effect, kind of letting death take its course. And then the other default can be trying to preserve life for as long as possible and doing all sorts of medical interventions. And you would think that something as big as a decision about someone's end of life care would be something that people would be really thoughtful about, and they would override that default. But actually, overwhelmingly, the evidence shows that people will just go with the default option there. And so if the default is the comfort pathway, they'll take that. And if the default is the preserving life pathway, they'll take that more than they would have done otherwise. And that's a really good example of where you would imagine that that's not just a hospital protocol that nobody's put any thought into. It's not a sort of mindless default. You would think if you were in hospital care that some doctor who knows about end of life care has spent some time thinking about that and setting it. And so that might be why you go with the default there, because you've never had to make a decision like that before. And so you take it as a cue of what an expert is recommending, when actually, in fact, you know, you can see from the very fact that some hospitals have one default and some have the other, that it's somewhat arbitrary.
Mm. And I guess it's getting to grips with these situations and making them non-arbitrary, which is where governments get excited about this kind of stuff and realise that they can, by carefully considering what they offer people, they can, I suppose, nudge people in particular directions.
Exactly that. So, attending to it's often called in behavioural science the choice architecture. So it's this idea of how choices are structured influences the decision we make as much as what the options on the table are. And so governments can be choice architects either by design or by accident, which has been this sort of historical legacy.
Yeah, and I remember in the book on choice architecture, there was a good example which really struck me, which was about how doctors present a course of treatment. And if they say there's a 90% survival rate, do you want to go ahead? People kind of go, oh, that sounds good. Yeah. If they say, well, there's a 10% chance that you'll die, that suddenly sounds totally different. You think, oh, I don't know, that could be awful. You know, and actually even just the way that things are communicated has a massive impact on which way we jump.
Yeah, and actually that example itself is really interesting, because it's not just patients that respond differently. You might expect a patient to respond differently because, again, they're not a trained medical professional. The only information they have is that particular nugget and the way that it's framed. But doctors themselves will choose a different course of action. Something like surgery versus radiation is one of the things that's been tested. They will choose a different course of action depending on whether you frame it as a gain, so talk about survival, or whether you frame it as a loss, talking about the risk of death. And these are people who you know, you would think would be the most kind of hyper-educated, rational agents that you could imagine, who are doing everything by the book and making all their decisions in a balanced way. And there's actually a lot of evidence that shows that a great deal of the decisions that doctors make are done on autopilot, using these same heuristics that we use to navigate our own lives.
It's quite frightening in a way when you realise that just the way something is presented can have such an impact. But the whole point of the growth of behavioural insights is governments, particularly policymakers, getting to grips with this and realising it can be used, well, hopefully, and we can come on to this, hopefully for good. And tell us a little bit about how and when governments started to get interested in this stuff.
Yeah, so in 2010, the behavioural insights team, which is my employer, was sort of created and launched. So governments had been thinking prior to that about how might we use some of these insights from the behavioural literature to influence how we make policy. But the British government was really the sort of first that formalised it and set up a office to do this in the highest levels of government. So it was the Prime Minister at the time that established it. It sat between 10 Downing Street and the Cabinet Office, which is, you know, basically the sort of the doing wing of a lot of kind of policy. And some of the very early things, you know, part of that establishment, it seemed at the time to be quite a sort of madcap thing to do, and so it was really important early on to pick some areas that seemed like it would be likely to yield good results. So some of the earliest examples, and my co-author Michael worked directly on these, were to do with revenue collection and particularly tax collection. So you've got these huge numbers of people who aren't paying their taxes, and for government that's a real headache. What it's quite easy to lose sight of is that even though it's an enormous number of people who haven't paid their taxes, as a fraction of people that owe taxes, it's a minority. It's a very small number of people. It's about 1 in 10 in the UK who have not paid their taxes by the time the sort of deadline comes. And so just using that insight of these people are in a minority and letting them know that was one of the first success stories. And it operates again on this idea of people want to conform, they want to follow the crowd, they don't want to be an outlier, for all sorts of very deep-seated reasons. And actually people's perceptions are often quite off the mark. So if you say to people, how many people do you think are not compliant on their taxes, people will grossly overestimate it. And so they don't realise when they haven't done it themselves that it is a minority behaviour. So just sending people a letter saying 9 out of 10 people pay their tax on time was transformative in terms of increasing the number of people who paid their taxes up very quickly after that. You can get even more specific. So, you know, people might make an excuse in their mind then when they think, yeah, sure, but my taxes are particularly complicated. So if you say 9 out of 10 people, most people with a debt like yours have already paid it, that sort of overcomes that quick excuse that people make. And then the other thing is, we relate even more to people that we consider to be sort of socially closer to us, to be more like us. So if you say the majority of people with a debt like yours in your local area have already paid their taxes, that bumps up the number of people complying again. And so these small sort of tweaks to these letters that are already going out, they're basically zero cost to adjust, brought forward about 200 million in additional tax revenues in a 12-month period when we first started running those studies. And that really kind of turned this from a slightly harebrained idea into something that everybody wanted a piece of.
Yeah, and because I guess previously, bluntly put, it might be that a government department collecting taxes thinks, oh, I'm fed up with these people not paying, I'm going to send them a really snooty letter saying, you know, if you don't pay, you will be punished. And they go at it very much with the stick approach. And knowing that that perhaps doesn't work is going to be hugely impactful. But for you as the scientist, you've got to do the work first to show what is and isn't effective. And how do you trial all this stuff?
Yes, so, you know, we approach it exactly as a scientist would, and we say it's an empirical question as to does the snooty letter or, you know, does the stick work better than the carrot, or does the social comparison work better than a threat, all of that kind of stuff. And so we set it up as basically a massive experiment in the same way that a scientist would. So in that particular example of tax collection, we would take everybody who has an outstanding debt who's going to receive the letter. We would randomly allocate those people to receive different variants of the letter. So let's say, you know, there are 5 different variants of the letter. And then we would look, you know, we'd wait 30 days after the letters went out, and then we would look at who paid up and what the average payment rate and amount is in each of those groups. And by doing that, you're able to get a really precise estimate, not just of which one works better, but to what extent does it work better. And so, you know, I've just described in very blunt terms a randomized control trial, but that's the approach that we basically use to figure out if this stuff works. And that's really important for a number of reasons. One I've alluded to, which is if you're a government, you should be absolutely obsessed with the extent to which something works and how much return on investment you're getting for it. So it does give you a good estimate of that. Two is it's sort of, you know, Trump's opinion every single time. You can say, no, definitively this thing works better. And three is that, particularly in the beginning, but still now, a lot of the research that we're building on the foundation of, a lot of these insights about human behavior are developed in completely different settings. So, you know, they're in labs where it's an artificial setting, it's undergraduates that are being studied, it's, you know, a completely different cultural context, all of those sorts of things. And so even though we might have a sort of decent theory or a decent hypothesis about what we think is going to work, it's really, really important to test whether that's true. Both for its own sake, but also to continue to build that body of evidence and make it stronger and more robust. And there's a lot of things that have not survived that test, and it turns out they don't really work outside of those laboratory settings.
And I wonder as well how easy it is to build pictures of human behaviour in those terms of this is human behaviour. Presumably there are, depending on your age, your gender, your ethnicity, there are default settings, are there, that work very differently depending on where you might be in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is one of the really exciting developments that's happening in the field now, is that we're starting to get much more, you know, in the same way that you can get kind of precision medicine and all of that sort of stuff, we're starting to do things like combining standard randomized control trials with data analytics techniques that enable you to say what works for who and to what extent. And you are starting to see these interesting results where something works on average, but it backfires for a particular sort of sub-segment of the population. There's some really good work that's done by one of our ex-colleagues who's now a professor at UC Berkeley, Elizabeth Linos, where she was looking at what makes people apply to join the police. And she was particularly interested, this is in a US context, she was particularly interested in, can you get people who are underrepresented to join the police force? So specifically, can you get women to apply to join the police force? And can you get people of colour to apply to join the police force? And she found by testing different messages that she was able to tease out not just what works for getting people to submit an application, but what works disproportionately well for those groups. And it's interesting because if you say things like, you know, if you think about public service messaging in general, something like police applications, the adverts will often have things like protect and serve or you know, that kind of stuff on them, which is very much about the sort of public service dimension. And it turns out that those messages don't work particularly well for anyone. They actually don't work much better than no advert at all, probably because nobody's surprised that that's something you would get out of working for the police. So anyone who wants to do that has already applied. But if you say things like, are you up for the challenge? This is a really challenging job. It turns out that that's much more appealing because it's not necessarily a dimension people would have thought about before, but it's disproportionately appealing to women and people of colour in this particular context. And, you know, of course, we don't know why. It's still a little bit of a black box when you run a trial like this, but it's really useful to know that the way that you frame the message can determine who you're attracting.
And it brings us back to that point, I suppose, that traditionally, and in a number of podcasts that we've done for Bokomi, I kind of come across this, that historically a lot of these fields of science have been so tailored towards a particular group of people because of the kind of scientists who are doing it. And in your book, you mentioned the acronym WEIRD, that historically we tend to look at people who are Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic. We're sort of basing our worldview on actually a very small part of the world.
Exactly, yeah. And and not just a very small part of the world, but about the most unrepresentative sample that you could possibly get. Because, you know, even if we drill into the WEIRD acronym, like I said before, a lot of the seminal studies that we're talking about are done, the ones that were done long ago, it's largely all male undergraduate students, let alone just undergraduate students. They're done in labs, all of these sorts of things. And as you said, Western educated, industrialized, rich, democratic, all of those things that the vast majority of people in the world don't look anything like on any dimension, the people that are used in these studies. One of my favorite sort of examples of this, which we talk a little bit about in the book, is not just about how people behave and how they act, but also about how the constructs that we measure might not mean the things that we think that they do. So there's this very famous experiment called the marshmallow test. There's actually been a bit of a resurgence, I've noticed, at the moment, with people making little videos of their kids doing something similar. But the original version of it was you give a little kid one marshmallow and you say, I'm just going to leave the room and you can have this marshmallow right now, but if you can hold out for 15 minutes or 5 minutes or whatever it is, then I'll come back and I'll give you a second marshmallow, but you only get that second marshmallow if you don't eat the first one and you can hold off. And they go, yeah, okay. And then there's all these incredibly cute videos of these kids trying to resist the marshmallow. It's totally delightful. And it sounds very sort of trivial, but the point is that those kids were followed up over a very long period of time. And it turns out your ability to defer gratification and not eat the marshmallow as a child has all of these sort of predictive qualities when it comes to how much money you're going to earn, what level of education you're going to get, all of that sort of stuff. So the sort of initial conclusion was, we've got this very, very early test which shows something about self-control, which translates into success in later life. Now, when that experiment has been rerun later on with a more diverse sample of kids, those original kids were all, you know, the kids of professors at a university, all of that sort of stuff. It turns out the picture's a lot more complex because there's all kinds of other things that are going into the equation. So if you're a kid, for example, that's learned that you can't always trust grown-ups to follow through and fulfill their promises, or if you're a kid that's particularly hungry and hasn't eaten, actually it might be rationally better, and it might be that the better decision for you is to just scoff the first marshmallow as soon as you get given it, because you don't know if the second one's ever going to materialize. And so actually when you look at things like that, and then you look at what all of that stuff is correlated with, suddenly the picture becomes a bit muddier about, well, was it the ability to defer gratification and not eat the marshmallow that translated into success in later life? Or was it, you know, that you have a fundamentally different kind of worldview and experience based on what's happened to you in early childhood?
And it's fascinating and also complex, as you've just highlighted. But one of the other points that you make in the book is, if you tweak one behaviour, if a government decides to take one approach and try and sort of move people towards something that they think is beneficial, of course, you might then force a different behaviour that you hadn't sort of foreseen, and that actually it's quite hard to do things totally freestanding without having a knock-on effect, sometimes one that is not something that you predicted.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the sort of seductive but false things about a linear scientific process and behavioural insights, you know, often falls into this, is that if you pull lever A, then lever B will move and it's lovely and linear and nothing else is going to happen. And of course, you know, we don't live in a world of sort of linear, straightforward systems. We live in a kind of complex systems world where things interact, and there are all kinds of unintended consequences that happen as a result of any action. And again, I think a really exciting development for the field of behavioral insights is recognizing much more of this complexity, accommodating it, and linking up with people that do systems thinking, for example, and just getting a lot more sort of sophisticated on that. Some of the work that's coming out at the moment on things like network effects and how information cascades through social networks and how people influence one another, I think is very interesting in that regard. But also from a government perspective, things like interventions in a food system, for example, you have to be really careful about not just displacing people away from one unhealthy food and towards another, or pricing people out of a market that previously they were able to access their healthy food from, for instance.
You've used words like influence and moving people in a particular direction, and that does highlight the issue that of ethics, essentially, and the misgivings some people have about this branch of science, that is it truly ethical to be manipulating people, some might say, towards a particular pathway or a particular choice, and for them not to know that they're being somehow pushed or nudged?
I think it's a great question, and it's certainly one that we should keep asking and needs to remain front and center. A couple of things that I think about in terms of the ethics side here. So one is the reality that there is no neutral choice. So once you start learning about choice architecture and looking at it in a bit more detail, you realize that all choices are architected in some way. It's just a question of whether it's deliberate or not. At some point, you kind of have to say, once you understand that and you realize that, if you're a policymaker, you sort of have an obligation to design for good and to be a sort of, you are a choice architect, and so you ought to do it deliberately. And so if we kind of take that, I suppose, as the sort of fundamental baseline of, you don't have an option anymore, you've got to design this choice architecture in a particular way, then it becomes a little bit more simple. I think the questions then are, number one, if somebody was to find out what it is you're doing, so you know you've written down a theory about how you're going to get people to do the thing that you want them to do, is it sort of embarrassing? Is it something that you would not be able to kind of answer public questions on? That is a good test. Number two, if you actually tell people what it is that you're doing and how you've designed the choice to nudge them, it turns out that doesn't really kind of influence too much whether the nudge is effective or not, because most people don't kind of react against it or reject the idea. So it's quite interesting that I think there's often an implicit assumption, maybe an explicit assumption, that these things have to be done in a sort of cloak and dagger hidden way. And actually, you can tell people exactly what you're doing and it will still sort of operate relatively effectively. And then the other thing that, you know, there's a whole kind of, there's a lot that we could talk about in terms of ethics. The other thing that I quite like to do in my projects, and always sort of seek to do in my projects, is you kind of want to get feedback from people who are actually, you're actually designing for throughout the process. So number one, at the very beginning, to understand the problem you're trying to solve and what the barriers to action might be and all of that stuff. Number two, when you're kind of prototyping a solution, can you co-design it? Can you come up with it with people? Can you test it out and see whether they, you know, hate it, feel it's coercive and manipulative, all of those kinds of things? And then number three, once you've sort of launched it and you're actually trying to evaluate the effect of it, can you combine the randomized control trial results? So the thing that's going to tell you, you know, on average, this did, this worked better, X worked better than Y, with kind of qualitative feedback from people who are actually experiencing it about what they think. And I think that that's a really good way to sort of make sure that you're keeping yourself honest.
Mm. I wonder, hearing you talk about that, because there are these overlaps with what you're doing to what people have been doing in advertising and marketing for years. And I wonder whether the world of behavioral scientists kind of divides into sort of the cowboys with the white hats and those with the black hats, you know, whether there's a dark side, and that you would never take these skills and go and try and sell people cheesecake. You only want to work in public policy. Do you see that in your world?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's sort of a divide. I mean, I'm sure the good guys can't be cowboys, but there's definitely not a sort of us and them camp. You're absolutely right that this is, you know, we're basically kind of kicking against the force of advertising that's been sort of working on this stuff for decades. I think one of the most interesting things is actually how grey the line between the kind of good and evil applications of this is, which might sound like a scary thing to say, but let me give you an example to make it better. So you might say something like, I would never work with McDonald's because, you know, McDonald's provides unhealthy food to loads of people and it's fueling an obesity crisis and all of this kind of stuff. However, if McDonald's were to come and say, you know, and this is a real project that's been done, can we nudge people towards eating healthier foods? By the way, for us, we earn a higher margin on salads, so it's much better if people will eat salad. Is that a bad thing to do because you're working with McDonald's, or is it a good thing to do because you're trying to get people to eat healthier foods? Or similarly, you know, now when they're touch kiosks, I know far too much about McDonald's because I'm a massive fan, but on their touch kiosks, they now have the option to, you know, round up your purchase to donate to charity, and the choice architecture, that's very interesting, all of those kinds of things. Is that a bad thing or is that a good thing? So I think, you know, you don't often get people who are saying, I'm trying to use behavioral science to sell cigarettes to teenagers in sub-Saharan Africa because all of the other countries have started you know, banning us from doing that. You don't really kind of see that explicitly. It's more in the sort of grey area, and I think it's an interesting debate.
While we're talking about behaviour, we can't not touch on the massive issue of coronavirus, the fact that, you know, the world is in lockdown. We're trying to get people back now, I suppose, to some sense of normality here in the UK particularly. And this issue of human behaviour, human instinct and unconscious decisions must be playing out in fascinating ways for people like yourself as you observe society starting to maybe go back to the workplace, travel around, think about sending their children to school and so on.
I mean, it's obviously the big question, and it's hugely behavioural in so many dimensions, from how do you get people to wash their hands all the way, you know, through the sort of spectrum. I think one of the things I find most interesting, this isn't necessarily to say it's the most prevalent or important thing, I just find it fascinating, is there's this concept of bounded ethicality. So if what we've been talking about so far is bounded rationality, this idea that we're rational beings up to a point and then we have all of these sort of curious quirks and rules that violate what a rational actor would do, bounded ethicality is somewhat similar when it comes to making ethical decisions. So you might have a sort of strong moral framework, there's a way that you kind of do things, you've got a sort of ethical code, all of that stuff, and then you do these weird things that violate it and you can't really explain why. And I think a really good example of, there's lots of really good examples of that we're seeing at the moment. So things like somebody might be in a personal position where they think, okay, I've got this cough. I'm not sure it's a new persistent cough and it's grandma's birthday and grandma would be absolutely devastated if I didn't go to her 100th birthday. So I'm probably all right to just go because I don't think I've got coronavirus. When actually, if you zoomed out and you thought there's a small chance that you've got coronavirus and you're going to go and see your 100-year-old grandma, obviously that's not the right thing to do. And yet we kind of tell ourselves these stories and we try and kind of make it, we kind of try and reason as to why we should be able to do something because it feels like it's the right thing to do, even though when you sort of impose the bigger framework, it's absolutely not. Or another kind of perhaps more common, less dramatic example would be you don't want to let your teammates down. And so you go into the office, even though you were feeling a little bit ropey the night before. And it will be interesting to see how this plays out. You know, I'm not kind of saying this is going to be the thing that floors society and gets us to have second, third, fourth waves, all of that kind of stuff. I just think it's a really interesting thing to watch out for and for people to hold themselves to personal account on.
Elizabeth Kirkman, thank you so much for sharing your OMI with us today. You can get a copy of Elspeth's book, Behavioural Insights, co-authored with Michael Hallsworth, which is out now, by clicking on the link in the podcast description. And if you'd like to hear more from the most wanted minds in business, science, technology and culture, please do subscribe on your chosen audio platform, where you can also like and review us. Do also sign up to our most wanted email at bocomi.com. That way, you'll get news of upcoming guests and access to our author intelligence service for clubs and companies. I'm Rachel Schofield. Thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye.